This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist Robert McNeil. He's the co-anchor and executive editor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour on public television. His intention on public television has been to create a reflective alternative to the commercial network news, or as he once put it, a place where TV journalism can slow down, take its time, and pick its way a little more coherently through the complexities of the day. Robert McNeil and Jim Lehrer have been partners for over a decade and have won TV's top broadcasting awards. McNeil has worked as a broadcast journalist in America, England, and his native Canada. Before taking his place behind the anchor desk, he traveled around the world as a foreign correspondent. As a young man, he was groomed by his father for a naval career, but he left naval training to try his luck as a playwright and radio actor. When he gave up on theater, he turned to journalism. He told me about the beginning of his journalism career.
I didn't set out to be a journalist in the first place. I was going to be a creative writer until I discovered I wasn't very good at it and I needed to earn a living. And then I got training in 5 years at Reuters News Agency in London. At that time, not only were there no journalism schools in Britain, but even university graduates were somewhat frowned on in Fleet Street. It was considered very much a craft, and it was not the best approach, but it was considered something, a kind of journeyman activity that somebody with a reasonably good basic education could do. And I still think that's true. I think journalism likes to give itself airs as a profession, but it doesn't require any of the disciplined education that the real professions do, the traditional professions. You don't have to spend 7 years studying as you do to become a doctor, to become a good journalist. You really can plunge in and do it on the job.
You learned some of the craft of journalism on the job working at Reuters.
In a wire service, yeah.
And you were a rewrite man for a while.
Right.
What was the typical, really maddening kind of work that you'd have to do under pressure that you think really taught you the ropes?
Well, just having to take a lot of raw material that came in from correspondents around the world who were not always native English speakers and who in those days, because of the communications, wrote in cablese, which was a very condensed form of English, leaving out most of the prepositions and connecting words, or else putting Latin prefixes or suffixes onto words so that they would count as one word. Like somebody going to Moscow, instead of saying to Moscow, which is two words, they would say ad Moscow, spelled as one word, which was permitted. It was a cablese convention you could do. Ex-London, spelled as one word, was out of London or from London. And you had to translate that into very crisp, saleable, in the British and other papers around the world, vivid, clear prose with all the facts checked and everything else. And once you got the hang of it, it became quite a good game, but it took about a year and a half to really get good and swift at it.
You've written that the craft aspects of British journalism didn't prepare you for American journalism. What was different about American journalism?
American journalism is much more unctuous and a great deal more self-important about its role in the world than British journalism is. British journalism varies enormously in seriousness, but it is, many parts of it, more of an entertainment. It is blessedly briefer, a lot of it. Part of it attributable to the great shortage of newsprint during the Second World War, when stories had to be, as they put it, subbed down, edited down very briefly. A British newspaper is much more crisply written and often more elegantly written, and there's a good deal more style and wit in the better papers, at least. They are free of the kind of heavy earnestness of some American journalism. And
you mean the sense of mission?
The sense of mission and the sense of being part, sort of quasi, playing a kind of quasi-constitutional role in the society.
You did foreign correspondent work pretty early on in your career and stuck with that for several years. Did you feel self-assured enough initially to fly into a country and cover battles there or interview the most important people there before, you know, you'd even gotten your bearings?
I felt I quickly acquired the skills of getting away with it is, I think, what what it counts. And I made a few real howlers early on. A lot of it is simpler than it seems. you acquire a kind of self-defensive ability not to make too many terrible mistakes and to use the information that you have without pretending to yourself or anybody else that you know everything that's going on, but to make use of what you've got. I mean, the extreme example would be you arrive at the airport in some war-torn country, and on the ride in your taxi between the airport and the hotel, you observe hastily everything that's going on in the streets, and then you get to your hotel and you write a description of the mood in Dakar today. Tense knots of people were gathered on street corners. A deep apprehensive air hangs over the city of Dakar today. Well, everybody's done a little bit of share of that. One of the things about flying into places where there's something nastiness going on, it is never as bad as you think it's going to be because of what you've already read in the press or heard on television or the radio before you go there. But I can remember flying into the Belgian Congo, into the Katanga end of it in 1960, when really bloodthirsty, curdling things had been happening. You know, there had been a revolt there, and the tribesmen were attacking the Belgians who were fleeing to the Rhodesian border, and there'd been an awful lot of killing. And I flew in there, and as the plane descended into the equatorial jungles, I began looking around for signs of guns pointing out of the woods heading at the plane, and on the road in from the taxi, I was looking for people who were going to materialize out of the jungle and shoot at me. I was terrified all the way in. And I got to a wonderful hotel in the middle of Elizabethville called the Leopold Deux, and there were all these British and American journalists sitting around drinking gin and tonic, very relaxed, and saying, well, yes, nothing much going on around here because there hadn't been anything. Not every inch of every city in every war-torn zone is raked by fire and trembling with explosions. I mean, in London, look at London during the Blitz. It's before my time, but, the Blitz was awful, and many people died, but life went on normally, and lots of people had a very good time during it, frightened out of their wits some of the time, but quite exhilarated the rest.
What were the stories in which you most felt you were really covering history in the making, that you were there for what was to later be recognized as a great moment in history?
Well, one was the Berlin Wall, clearly. I don't think it had any doubt. I mean, sometimes you just don't know, and for years later you don't realize the significance of something. But the Berlin Wall clearly was. I had a number of occasions where I arrived places by accident where things began to happen, and one of them was there. I was sent by NBC I was in London, and was sent to Berlin to cover the bureau there because the resident correspondent was going to be away working on a documentary. And I went to Berlin, and I checked into the Kempinski Hotel and went out and had dinner, and then I was feeling tired, so I went to bed. And about 3 in the next morning, the news desk in New York rang up and said, what's this about they're closing the border? And I said, I don't know anything about it. They said, well, there's a story on the wire that the East Germans have closed the border to East Germany. Of course, there was a lot of tension over Berlin that summer, so I don't know. I'll go and find out. I dressed and got a taxi down to the Brandenburg Gate just at dawn on a nice August day, Sunday, and there were the East German guards putting up barbed wire across the Brandenburg Gate and rolling huge cement flower pots into position as a kind of fence to block the traffic, which was the beginning of the building of the Berlin Wall. And I just knew that was a momentous thing. I mean, there had been all sorts of speculation that summer about something the Soviets or the East Germans might do and whether it might provoke the West into something that could ultimately lead to war. And this was regarded as a major provocation. And for the next few days, although the West ultimately did nothing, there was a sense in the air that very terrible things could happen, you know. So that was a moment of history. Another was the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was indirectly involved in that. I mean, or directly involved. By accident, I arrived in New York one night from London to do some personal business with NBC, and I was going to go and check in my hotel and go out. And Ed Newman, who was a friend of mine, said, you better stick around. Kennedy's going to speak, and we think it's something on Cuba. So I stuck around, and Kennedy announced the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I was whisked off to Washington to help in the Pentagon and the State Department coverage there. And then a few days later, because I had a Canadian passport, they said, why don't you try and go to Cuba? And so I eventually got to Cuba by going down to Mexico City and just buying a ticket on Cubana Airlines. As a result, I ended up there with a bunch of European journalists and one Japanese, and they had visas, I didn't. But we all got locked up in rooms in a hotel, and were held there for 9 days and observed what we could see of the Cuban Missile Crisis going on out the windows, and got involved in all kinds of amusing attempts to get the word out that we were there and everything else. But a real sense of being in a historic moment then.
Yeah, you were basically held under house arrest in a hotel in Cuba.
With armed guards outside the door and all that.
What were you told?
Nothing.
How did you end up? Did they round you up and take you
away? Yeah, at gunpoint. They said, you're coming downtown. And we got into a truck, and then we went into the hotel lobby, and Cuban Army officer said, you're going to be the guests of the Cuban government. And I said, no, I'm NBC, and I'm going to pay my own way, and I don't want to be your guest, thank you. You're going to be the guest of the Cuban government. So we were put in rooms, and they cut off the phones. We were at one end of a corridor, and they put two chairs outside, and there were Cuban soldiers with machine guns on their laps outside. And so while all the most fraught days of the Cuban Missile Crisis were going on, we were on the ninth floor of the Capri Hotel, able to look out over the harbor and see Soviet ships and other things there, look down at the rather antiquated anti-aircraft guns that the Cubans were jumping onto and wheeling around very rapidly every time some American reconnaissance planes flew over. We didn't know whether it was going to be an American air raid, as there was some talk of, or not. But eventually, after a lot of false attempts, once we knew that they weren't going to shoot us or do anything harmful to us, it was just boring and sometimes very amusing. But I spent the Cuban Missile Crisis eating arroz con pollo, two meals a day, with Bulgarian wine, $5 a bottle, and doing exercises for 2 hours a day because I knew how imprisonment could weaken a man. And
well, you were imprisoned at least twice during your career as a foreign correspondent. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of journalists now, when they're reporting, especially in a war-torn country, feel that they are the targets of both the guerrillas and the government. Well, did you ever feel that way when you were a journalist, that you were as likely to be attacked by the government or guerrilla forces?
No, only in... I felt that way a couple of times in France because the French, some of the French security forces, for instance, in Algeria, were no lovers of the foreign press corps because they thought that we sided with the Algerian nationalists fighting for independence, and particularly the para regiments, the paratroop regiments, who were very tough. A lot of them were foreign legion. They were very tough. I remember one day I was in Algiers, and there was some anniversary, and the government had forbidden the nationalists, the FLN, to demonstrate. And they'd quartered off the city with barbed wire and brought in extra troops. And we were patrolling around looking for stories, journalists snooping around looking for stories. I was with NBC then, yeah. And I did get a story that day. A story that really sickened me. We kept driving around looking for things, and then our car alone came to the bottom of a hill just on the outskirts of Algiers, and at the top of the hill there was a large apartment building, apartment complex, and there were Algerians in the top of the hill having a wild demonstration, waving banners, shouting, and loudspeakers and everything. And just as we got there, a detachment of French colonial troops with French officers was deploying to go up the hill to stop the demonstration. So I got out and with my little tape recorder, radio days, nice radio days where a reporter can operate on his own, climbed the hill behind them, just behind the troops. And we got near the top of the hill, and suddenly somebody in the apartment building opened fire in our direction with a heavy machine gun. And not very pleasant to be shot. We all threw ourselves down, the troops, I with the troops, I in a gully near the top of the hill. And beside me, the French lieutenant who was commanding the thing had been wounded badly in the thigh, right up at the top of the thigh, and blood was gushing out of his thigh in a great sort of geyser. And he put his two thumbs on the pressure point to stop the bleeding. I noticed that very vividly, and I was lying very close to him. and the firing was going on over our head, and all these troops lay down, the French troops lay down on the top of the hill, and they blazed away with everything they had for about a minute and a half at that building, which was absolutely, the front of the building, all the balconies and everything, covered with women and children. And there was this incredible noise and screaming and shooting, and then a big silence. And when the silence ended, a couple of things happened, some sort of moaning. And before I went over the top of the hill, a jeep with a French colonel came roaring up this bumpy hill and stopped beside this wounded officer. And I watched the colonel got out, and he saluted the officer who was on the ground, and the officer took his right hand, such was his discipline, he took his right hand away from the pressure point on his thigh and saluted, "Bonjour, mon colonel," like this, so that the blood started to spurt again, and then he put it back. Anyway, they carted him off, and I went up over the top of the hill, and it was just devastation. I mean, there was absolutely no need to... for that kind of behavior. It was a pity that somebody in the apartment had opened fire with a machine gun. And these people went through there. There were all sorts of men, women, and children killed and wounded. They later said that something like 7 were dead and 50 injured, but there were many, many more dead than that. And I remember there was a man came running to me. I suppose he thought I was something official, and he came running up to me with a wild look in his eyes, and he was carrying a small child in his arm, and the small child had a very big hole in one leg where a large caliber bullet had blown a big hole, and this child was moaning, and this man kind of presented the child to me as though I could do something with it, and then when he saw that I couldn't, he sort of ran away. And I remember feeling so extraordinarily detached from it, as though it were a silent... even though I was hearing sound and smelling smells, as though I were somebody watching a silent movie, I am not here.
Do you think that was part defense mechanism and part journalistic response?
I don't know what it was. We'd all persuaded ourselves that in those days journalists were tough guys who didn't feel anything and no emotion came in. And I suppose you pushed it all away somewhere and prided yourself on your not giving into any personal feelings, which is crazy. I mean, the story would have been so much better reported with a lot of personal feeling, that kind of story.
My guest is Robert McNeil, who is the co-anchor and executive editor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. After years of working in the trenches, so to speak, as a foreign journalist, being under fire, being arrested several times, you went to NBC to work as an anchor.
That's right, yeah.
And I wonder if you enjoyed anchoring, where you were basically bound to the offices and the studios most of the day, and what you thought of the position, if you think the position is overrated on the network news.
I was too young for the job then. I hadn't got the other part out of my system. I came back to work in the States for a while. I worked at the White House and did quite a lot of civil rights coverage in the South and so on, and then was moved to New York. But I had come back to the States with the understanding I was going to get a foreign bureau, which to my mind was a good job. I didn't know anything about this anchoring business. And I hated it. I enjoyed the attention, and I enjoyed the money, and I enjoyed the feeling of success that goes with it, and I really thought it was a terribly empty job because I could write very little of it myself. I did the Saturday show with Ray Shearer that was the sixth day of Huntley Brinkley, first time there was a network news show on Saturday, and I did the first hour local television show. I mean, since then, hour local shows have become a commonplace. In fact, I think the dynamic in television news has passed from the networks to local. Anyway, I did that, and I would sit down. At about 6 minutes to six, I would get 70 or 80 pages of copy that had been written and sit down and start reading through that live on the air, often with just enough time in the two commercials to leaf through the next few pages to quickly glance over them, seeing them for the first time.
Was it hard for you to read other people's writing? You've, after all, you'd really honed your writing skills.
No,
you've taken pride in your writing, and you probably didn't like what you were being given.
I can read anybody's writing, but I would much sooner read my own, not because my own is better, but just because I'm intimate with it and because it's more familiar. But lots of writers in television can write very well for other people, and that's the standard procedure. But it's not only reading somebody else's copy, but if it's dumb stories or stories that you think are trivial or being so trivialized by being so briefly done. And that was the beginning of my disenchantment with the whole thing, my 2 years as a network and local anchorman. I kept pining to get out, and I did occasionally break away, but there was a strong disincentive to go out and report. If I went out, for instance, I did during the, because the Huntley Brinkley Show said, well, you cover the governors for us in 1966, 20 years ago. You cover the governors, and then you do the governors on election night. And that's a big deal, the big network election nights. So I said, well, if I'm going to cover the governors on election night, I've really got to go out and cover these races. So they said, all right, you go out and cover the races. So what happens when you go out and cover the races? You don't do the shows that you're lined up to do as an anchorman, which means you don't get paid for them, because you get paid, in those days, you got paid talent, commercial talent fees for each appearance and everything. I thought the whole system was absurd. And on that election night, as it happened in 1966, I was covering the governors, and along with Huntley and Brinkley and Chancellor and that bunch. And a man from the BBC came backstage, as it were, afterwards, and I'd known him before in England. And he said, why don't you come and work for us? And I said, I will. and I did. And I left NBC. But I understand better temperamentally and professionally. I understand better the position of anchorman, perhaps because I am one. But also, I never wanted to be that kind of anchorman again. And in fact, I've refused a couple of jobs since then. I know the function they perform, and it's enormously influential. But I'm also, you see, I recognize I'm not that good a news reader and presenter. I mean, there are many people in the business who do it far better than I do in terms of those qualities that transmit well through the screen and attract a wide audience and, you know, the sort of on the scale of being dynamic and all that kind of thing. I'm not in those sticks, so I wouldn't do that very well anyway. If all you're doing is having to squeeze your entire personality and presence and authority into a number of 15 or 20-second bursts throughout a half-hour program to introduce a lot of other reports, that's not my forte.
What do you consider to be your strength and what you love to do?
I think the thing that I'm very proud of is having looked around and used the experience I acquired with various places, including the BBC, 8 years at the BBC, to say what is not being done here. What is network news failing to do, this wonderful medium for journalism? And it seemed to me that it was most conspicuously failing to do anything in the way of any in-depth, interpretive, analytic searching exploration of daily journalism. And so I was invited back 11 years ago to start such a program and invented the concepts that became the McNeil-Lehrer Report and are the fundamental part of the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour.
When you first started to work for public television, it was through NPAC, the National Public Affairs Center for Television, which was basically attacked by the Nixon administration, and that's been revealed in detail through documents released through the Freedom of Information Act. And you left public television because you were so tired of that, of being politically under fire all the time, right?
Yeah.
What do you think of the condition of public television now? Some people say public television never recovered from the Nixon administration attacks and that it's been afraid to, in most of its programming, take on issues or have on any kind of programming that would really make a direct challenge to the government. And I'd really like to know what you think.
I don't think that's true. I think that television not only survived, public television not only survived the Nixon administration, it survived it triumphantly. I mean, the great irony was that after nearly being run out of town by the Nixon White House in Sandy Van Oker and I when we were doing this the one-year thing called NPACT, which was an attempt to set up a kind of PBS News in Washington, a politically premature attempt. We came back. Sandy left. Jim Lehrer replaced Sandy, which is where I got to know him. And we came back and anchored, Jim and I, the public television continuous coverage of the Watergate hearings, which, of course, led to Nixon's downfall. Not that we had a sense of revenge doing that, but those Watergate hearings, because commercial television never covered them in their entirety. And if you remember, public television also, we rebroadcast them at night when everybody could watch. That brought an enormous audience to public television. It doubled and trebled the memberships of prominent public television stations because people were so grateful for an opportunity to see these hearings.
You openly refer to yourself as a liberal, yet you're really one of the most objective reporters I can think of. And when it comes to handling a debate, I mean, it would be very difficult for someone to guess what side you are on. You really do such an excellent job of being fair in whatever issue you cover. Do you think it's a conflict at all to come out and say you're a liberal?
It would have been, I think, a deceit, and it would have been a lie not to say something about it. My education, my background, my instinctive political reactions when I was very young were all very liberal. I am less automatically liberal on every issue, if there is a liberal position on every issue nowadays, than I used to be. I am on some, and I'm not on others. But I've found that the more I know about issues, and Jim and I have this experience constantly, before we sit down to really read into an issue in the afternoon, we have a very definite position on it, one or other, sometimes both of us, sometimes on the conservative side, sometimes on the liberal side, often due to the personalities involved. And we've repeatedly had this experience that after a couple of hours, we'll ring the other up. We have a phone which we can talk to each other all the time. Ring the other up and say, you know, now that I read this stuff, it really looks very different. And I think many people, whatever their political instincts, are often reacting out of not knowing the facts very much in a situation. Also, issues get a great deal more complex nowadays. I mean, how many issues are there? I mean, the Vietnam War isn't running. It was easy to be a liberal in the Vietnam War. At least it was easy to be anti-war because it was such a dumb thing for this country to be doing. It's very difficult nowadays to have a clear, easy, knee-jerk, quick, this is right, this is wrong opinion on the issues of the day.
That was journalist Robert McNeil, co-anchor and executive editor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour on public television. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Paul Kerber. The program was edited by Maeve McGoran. Assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.